is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery. Beginning April 11th, Emergence, International Women in the Arts, an exhibition of works by multiple artists. Also featuring Tish Inahosa, nationally known recording artist from Austin, Texas, on April 13th. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom at 17 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When we look at beautiful buildings and structures, we take stock of how they look. We may think of the architect, but beauty is more than skin deep. What lies beneath is critical. Without a solid structure, a building cannot stand. And if the people within the building find it inhospitable, they will abandon the building. On the program today, our guest is an engineer responsible for the structural design of hundreds of buildings and structures around the world, including the World Trade Center. Among his other designs, the United States Steel Headquarters in Pittsburgh, the Bank of China in Hong Kong, and museums in Berlin and Portland, Maine. Our guest is Leslie Robertson. He is the recipient of many honors. He is one of 20 structural engineers who were named by Engineering News Records 125 top people of the past 125 years. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. You can join us with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Leslie Robertson is visiting the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where this evening he'll present the Michael J. Tice Memorial Lecture. The lecture is set for 7 p.m. at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall, located at 611 East Laredo Taft Drive in Champaign. The public is invited. If you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thanks for coming in this afternoon and joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You began your career in the 1950s, so you've been a pioneer in in the field of computers and the application of computers to design. Can you give us some sense of where things were when you started in the 1950s and today? You know, how has the computer affected the field?
Well, I went to school at Berkeley, and the computers there were analog computers, not digital computers. I think at the Livermore Laboratories there was one digital computer, but I've never worked in the atomic field, and because I'm basically opposed to war in all senses. But I started working on analog computers, and then as time went on, the digital computers became available. The first one we had in our offices was an IBM 1620. It was a living room size computer, probably not as powerful as most people's laptops today. It was called the Cadet, which we figured out right away meant can't add, didn't even try, because it looked up 3 plus 3 in tables to find that it added to 6. It didn't have adding circuits in it even.
Huh.
So then over the years, of course, the computers have gotten very much better, faster, easier to use. Both the hardware and the software have improved enormously.
Was the Cadet any use to you at all?
Oh, sure. The Cadet accomplished the designs for the World Trade Center. So it obviously did a whole lot of work. But it was laborious. I mean, a disk drive that you're used to thinking about as something you can slip in your pocket was the size of a washing machine and so forth. It was a different kind of world at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. The Cadet was a wonderful computer. It was the fastest and largest of IBM's medium-scale computers, and its first all digital.
Yeah. So when you started, you were already in the computer age? The slide rule was already out the door?
Well, not exactly. No, not true. When I started work, I say all the work was done either on calculating machines, that is, mechanical calculators, or with a slide rule. Sure. That was the technology of the time.
Yeah.
But you have to remember that my grandfather was not a structural engineer, but had he been one, I'm sure he would have turned out some wonderful designs without benefit of digital computers.
Well, sure. Well, we have some wonderful buildings that are still with us today that are 100 years old.
Of course.
Yeah. And some beautiful buildings still standing in New York City from the 1930s, Empire State,
mm-hmm.
and the Chrysler Building.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are the structures of the older buildings, are they significantly different from the skyscrapers constructed a half century later?
Well, the...
Constructed today.
Sure. The skyscrapers of the 30s, actually the high-rise building began shortly before the turn of the century, but as it evolved up to the time of the Second World War, the taller buildings were built almost exclusively of structural steel, and they were built with relatively close column spacing, that is, say, columns 30 feet on center in all directions, which was fine, made for really good buildings, but the usefulness of the space was enormously reduced because of all the columns. And then further, the computational tools were not all that good. People learned by building a little bigger and a little bigger each time. And the structures of those buildings relied very heavily on the masonry that was both inside and outside of the building itself. So if you took, let's take an Empire State Building. If you took the Empire State Building and removed all of the stone and masonry and replaced it with metal and glass, the building would be totally unsatisfactory. As a matter of fact, it might even collapse. Now, the engineers of that time didn't really know how to quantify that in a rational kind of way, but they knew from experience that those systems worked.
Yeah. Paul Goldberger wrote a piece for The New Yorker following September 11th about skyscrapers, and he said of the World Trade Center, it was structurally innovative. Earlier skyscrapers were supported by complex frames of steel or concrete columns and beams. Their exteriors were a curtain wall of metal, glass, or masonry hung from the frame, their interiors broken up by the grid of columns and beams. The Trade Center, very different. He describes it as a vast tube.
Well, okay. That's a little difficult concept to get across, but if you imagine a tube which is square, if you bury it in the ground, it will cantilever up, and would take lateral push from you or from other sources. The Trade Center was just a huge expansion of that thought. I mean, it was almost an acre in size on each floor, so the tube was very, very large. But the point here is that the systems that resisted the loads from wind and earthquake existed solely on the perimeter of the building. They did not exist inside the building. And that allowed the planning of the building to move in directions that weren't possible before, because this grid of columns that Paul Goldberger talked about seriously hampered the placement of elevators and stairs, mechanical rooms, and indeed a large conference room, because it could not be bigger than 30 feet square mm-hmm. without having a column in it. So the Trade Center was very unique in that respect.
Would it be accurate to say that in the World Trade Center, the skeleton was both outside and inside the building?
Well, there were columns inside the building, but they were located around the elevator shafts and so forth. They were not in public spaces or normally occupied spaces, let us say. And that was very different from buildings of the past. Hmm. But it had structure on the inside as well. But the point being that the lateral push on a building from the wind, for example, is rather substantially larger than the forces that go onto the floor. That is, the furniture and people and all of that is a lot less than the wind load. So the largest force on a high-rise building is the lateral push from the wind, not the gravity load part.
Yeah. Well, preparing for this interview today, I spent some time thinking about the wind. Hmm. And I have a relative who lives in a high-rise in the city of Chicago. And the building has to move in the windy city.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's really windy, you can see the chandelier swinging, but mm-hmm. I don't feel like I'm at sea at all.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. Got to be quite an accomplishment.
Well,
what goes into making that happen?
Yes. Recognizing that the World Trade Center, first of all, was $1 billion at that time, which is a whole lot of money then. And it was a new structural concept, and it didn't have the masonry that it existed in all prior buildings. It was the first building that didn't use masonry because of a partition system that we developed called shaft wall. So the question is, well, how much can you allow the building to move in the wind? The steady state part, that is, it leans over, is not an issue, but it's the swaying part that you're talking about. That's what makes the chandelier swing. Or water slosh in the mm-hmm. sink, and if it's enough so that you feel it. I went around the United States and I rode in all kinds of motion simulators put together for ships and automobiles, the space race and so forth, and decided that none of them really replicated that which we were anticipating for the project. So we built our own simulator. We built it in a little town in Oregon as far away from New York City as possible so that the fact that buildings sway in the wind is not exactly good press. so we hid it, if you will. And we tested a variety of people under varying circumstances to find out how much swaying motion we could permit in the building and still have a building which was satisfactory. Now, the psychologist said, well, people ride in airplanes, so why can't they ride in your building? We found that was not the case. Mm. That when the motion gets up to kind of perception level, then it acts very much as the rolling ship and the seasickness sets in and so forth. So that was the criteria that we used actually for the structural design of the building.
Yeah. Well, we might ride in airplanes, but we don't really want to live in them.
That's true.
Yeah.
We don't want to live in them. And when you're concentrating, when you're on the airplane and it gets bumpy, you put on your seat belt and maybe you lean back, but you put your computer away or whatever you're doing and have a little nap. But in a building, you can't do that, of course. And the criteria is very different from a building which is used for offices, for example, than one which is used for residential or for a hotel or hospital.
Yeah.
Because the people in those buildings are there 24 hours a day. And so the criteria is more stringent for that kind of building than it is for an office building.
So you use the simulator to find out what people would be comfortable with.
Yes.
In the building. Did it also play another role in terms of what you would select for building materials and if, in fact, the design would work?
Well, the design was totally dependent on providing a building in which particularly the dynamic component of the motion of the building was small enough so that it was not a problem in terms of the comfort of the people in the building. Now, that led us to yet another innovation in the project, and that was the introduction of damping. That's a kind of a complex thought, but if you think of a screen door, And if you put a little device on it, it closes slowly. And if you don't have that device on, it slams.
Yeah.
So in essence, we put a whole lot of little devices like that into the World Trade Center to chew up or to use the energy of the oscillation of the building and change it into heat. And that way we're able to limit the structure motion to acceptable values for people.
Yeah. Well, here in the studio, we have a device like that on this big, huge, heavy door. If we didn't, we'd be doing a lot of...
Right. Well, our device is very different from that, but the concept is the same.
Same idea.
Same idea, right.
Yeah.
And now that's very common. Actually, the technology in that area has moved ahead a lot, but those devices are very effective. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, the operators of the building never got a complaint about building motion. People could hear the motion because the building creaks a little bit and sometimes see the motion because as the building twists just a tiniest little bit, then things on the horizon move so you can see it. And then there are the hanging plants and so forth that generate an understanding that the building is moving. So the tenants knew the building was moving. There was no question in their mind about it. But it was not a seasickness problem. It was not disturbing to them in their everyday work activities.
Yeah. Another thing about wind and buildings and the urban landscape is that in Chicago, for example, on a very cold, windy day, you might round a corner, come around a building, and suddenly you're hit full force with the wind. So the buildings have to have some kind of relationship to one another, do they not, in terms of how the wind moves through the city? And is that a factor also in structural design for wind?
Mm. Prior to the design of the World Trade Center, there had been no consideration of effects like that. And indeed, a few buildings had been tested in a wind tunnel, but the wind tunnel was, we call it an aeronautical wind tunnel. It did not replicate the kind of turbulence that exists in the real atmosphere. But with the World Trade Center, we were able to look at that exact question to sort out how much of the year the plaza would be useful for people sitting, standing, walking around, and so forth, and also to organize planting and so forth to minimize this effect that you're talking about. There are a few buildings that actually improve the street-level wind environment. By improve it, I mean reduce the wind speed. But most buildings, most tall buildings, increase the wind speed at street level, sometimes very substantially.
Yeah.
Of course, there are places, let's go to Singapore, where a little windiness at the street level is really nice. So there's no,
yeah.
Try to encourage that that facet of life. Indeed, in Chicago, in the summertime, windy streets are kind of nice.
Yeah, exactly.
And I might add that Chicago is not a particularly windy city. I mean, I know it's called the windy city. That's because it's on the lake. But in fact, the wind speeds in Chicago are rather lower than almost everywhere up and down the eastern seaboard.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've all seen what takes place in Florida. And that same kind of windstorm from time to time gets as far north as New York and Boston.
Yeah.
So the really windy cities in the United States are on the eastern seaboard, but the really windy cities in the world are in the Pacific, that is Hong Kong, places like that where the incidence of, they call it typhoon, we call it hurricane. Where the incidence of these great windstorms is very common. Indeed, in a place like Hong Kong, when a typhoon or hurricane is anticipated, people just don't go to work. Actually, the city is basically shut down for a period of time until the winds recede.
Hmm. But still the buildings have to stand.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, structural engineer Leslie Robertson. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Mahomet on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes.
Hi.
There was a PBS program a few years ago about the World Trade Center, and I'm not sure if you were interviewed on it or not, but they did interview the engineers who worked on the World Trade Center, and they admitted that they underestimated the wind loading by 10% when designing the structure, and that also they flew simulations of Boeing 707s into the building, because that was the largest airplane at the time, but that the fuel tanks on these simulations were empty, and I cannot understand why they would simply run a simulation with an airplane and not have full fuel tanks. So I'll just ask you those questions and get off the line. Thanks a lot.
Well, I mean, there have been so many television programs about the World Trade Center, and I've been on more than I wish. The World Trade Center was not, in fact, under-designed by 10%. In fact, the wind loads that were used on the World Trade Center exceed those stipulated in any building code in the United States for New York area, usually quite considerably. It was designed for a load of about five times larger than the requirements of the New York City Code of its time. That is about six times larger than that for which the frame of the Empire State Building was designed and so forth. So I don't know where the 10% came from, but that's not true. Now, with respect to simulation, again, I'm not sure what TV program you're talking about. What I can tell you is that we designed the structural system for the World Trade Center for a circumstance that was not so different from the Mitchell bomber that struck the Empire State Building in the Second World War. That was a plane lost in the fog trying to land at what was then called Idlewild, now called JFK. And we presumed that such an event might take place with the World Trade Center. That is, that a 707 jet might get lost in the fog and might actually run into the building. But we were anticipating a slow-flying, a 707 about to land at Idlewild. Now, under that circumstance, first of all, it carries very little fuel. More importantly, the plane would be traveling at a much lower speed. Now, the aircraft that hit the World Trade Center were heavier, not a lot heavier, but they were a bit heavier than the 707. But more importantly, they were flying above their rated speed, and they were, of course, fuel laden. The only comprehensive report that is available to the public that deals with that circumstance was put together by the United States government. I think it was, $16 million worth of engineering studies. And the conclusion of that study is that the buildings would be standing today if it were not for a second incident taking place. That is, the structures were robust enough to accept these aircraft. But the second event that took place were the fires. Now, the fires from the fuel were not what brought down the towers. What brought down the towers were fires from the contents of the building set off by the fuel. Don't know if I've answered your question, but that's the best I can do, I guess.
Yeah, to kind of follow up on the listener's questions, what kinds of extraordinary events are taken into account now in a building's design? We mentioned weather, typhoon, hurricane, tornado. And you mentioned, when the World Trade Center was designed, the possibility of a plane being lost or disabled in some kind of bad weather. What kinds of extraordinary events are taken into account? How do you think about what could happen in the future?
Well, There are a lot of events that are dangerous to buildings, and not mentioned so far has been the earthquake, which is not a large issue in very tall buildings, but certainly in smaller ones. But the great danger in buildings, whether it's a one-story building or a 10-story building or a 100-story building, the great danger in buildings and to the people in the buildings is fire. And a fire comes from many sources. And I should expand that, say, fire and fire-related incidents, which perhaps smoke is the largest other component there. But the lives that are lost in buildings overwhelmingly are due to fire. And if there's a place where money should be spent to make major buildings more safe, I believe that is the area which is most important. I have no belief that we should be designing our high-rise buildings for aircraft taken over by terrorists. I think that there are many risks in life, and that certainly is one of them. But at the same time, we have to build buildings which are places where we enjoy to live and enjoy to work. And if we start building forts instead of buildings for people, then we'll lose that. There are a lot of other factors that go into it. I mean, you when you get on the airplane, there are all kinds of security issues that are put in place today. But I don't know. It's really not my field. But I suspect that if a terrorist took over an aircraft today, and it certainly is possible to do that, despite the systems that are now in place, I think it's now known by the terrorists that the passengers on the airplane will get up and fight. That is, no longer is there this thought, take me to Cuba. That's gone out of everyone's mind. If a plane is hijacked, everyone's going to get up and fight, as I'm sure all the listeners here would do. And there are lots of other ways for terrorists to work than trying to take over passenger aircraft. In any event, following the terrible event in the Trade Center, we had a variety of buildings under design. The tallest one is 500 meters, which is now under construction, which is very much taller than the World Trade Center was. But developers, particularly developers in the Far East, where tall buildings are very common today, were interested in what it meant to them, this event. And I was asked to meet with the owner developers of many of those buildings, and not just my voice, but mine and many others, were able to convince them that the tall building is still the safest kind of building to be in, as you're safer in a bigger building than you are in a smaller one, just as you're safer in that great Boeing 747. Than you are in the little Piper Cub or whatever, the single-engine aircraft. Because the big buildings have behind them a reservoir of engineering and know-how that's not possible to put into smaller buildings. So if we're going to save lives, I think you might each take a look at your own house and see if you've put in place the evacuation system so that your children and family can leave that building safely in the case of a fire. Do you test your smoke detectors regularly and so forth? You know, most people just don't do that.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champagne, line 2. Good afternoon.
Hello. Yes, interesting. Discuss the limits on the height of a building, like from the 30s and today's technology, for instance. Wright had a design for a so-called mile-high building and said a lot of trade-offs would have to occur, like people might have to have supplies of water stored up high in the building and so on.
Well, okay. First of all, Frank Lloyd Wright was a wonderful architect, incredibly talented, a genius in architecture. But his Mile High Building was conceived at a time when he was not exposed to the difficulties in building the kind of building that he had envisioned. And that kind of building has not been built and will not be built, just based on the technology. Now, there is no difficulty in pumping water reliably up to the height of a 10-story building or a 100-story building or a 200-story building or a 300-story building. All that's completely inside of the technology. Water storage, I think, would be, if there were water storage, it would be for different purposes, perhaps recreation, swimming pools, the various kinds of damping devices which use water and so forth, but not for people to consume. No reason to do that.
Is there a limit to how tall a building can be?
Well, if you think the kind of ideal shape for a very, very tall building or structure, probably if I pointed to the Eiffel Tower, I'd say that's very close to the ideal structure, put together by two Swiss engineers, very talented guys. And so if you wanted to build a building that reached to the moon, I suppose you could do it. What you would need would be a huge amount of real estate in order to get a base large enough. You'd have to have it on the equator because of forces associated with rotation of the Earth. As a thought down that line, actually, the Space Agency has held several conferences to discuss a space elevator, which is a kind of building. In concept, you go out into space and find a great big rock, and you get on the equator and you build a really tall tower, and you connect the two together with structure, and then you run elevators up and down it as a technique for moving merchandise out into space. So I think as buildings get taller and taller, let's suppose you want a building that's a mile or two high, then you have to think about other things. When you get on the bus to go someplace, you don't mind standing there for maybe 5 minutes or even 10 minutes till the next bus comes along. And in a very, very, very tall building, it might be just like that. You might be waiting 5 or 10 minutes until the next bus comes along to take you vertically up into the building to the top. A different kind of mentality would be in place. Indeed, today, in most buildings in the Far East, most new buildings in the Far East, most elevators are two stories high. That is, they're double-deck elevators. So if you want to go to an even floor, you go to one place and get in that elevator. If you want to go an odd floor, you go to another floor to get into it, and so forth. So a lot of technology is in place for that kind of lift. And obviously, with two-story lifts, you could have 5-story lifts or 10-story lifts or whatever, depending upon how high you're going to go from the ground.
Hmm. And the materials, the things that you would use to build these structures, they exist? And
sure.
Yeah.
The materials, the structural materials, are easy. Most of the design, the structural design of a very tall building is not related so much to the strength of the building as it is to the performance of the building. How much can it move in the wind and so forth? How vibrations and floors and various issues like that. It's the performance side that really drives the structural systems of all major buildings. The materials are available. Actually, you know, the highest strength steel is readily available for structure is about 3 times stronger than the steels that were prevalent when I started in the profession. But those really high-strength steels are seldom used. And the reason is that you need a certain kind of stiffness or in the building, and as you make the material higher and higher strength, it obviously gets smaller and smaller, and so it gets less stiff, and that's undesirable. So I don't think there's a material difficulty.
Hmm. You mentioned the Eiffel Tower, and I read somewhere that when the Eiffel Tower was first built, when it was first unveiled, that it was criticized for not being Parisian, for not being of France. That, of course, changed. Does the way you see a building you worked on change over time?
Well, first of all, my personal opinion is that the high-rise building is not of a culture. That is, the high-rise building that works well in Chicago is going to work equally well in Sao Paulo or in Beijing. Sometimes some architects have made an attempt to put in a kind of ethnic spin on the buildings, but I think universally they fail. That the high-rise building is a thing unto its own.
Hmm. Maybe even talk with us now about the structural engineering work you did with Ampei in Japan, the Miho Museum and Bridge, which is, I've seen, you know, photographs of it on your website, Leslie E. Robertson Associates. The initials are the website, Lera, LERA.com. It looks beautiful. And it's part of this is underground.
Well, the museum... first of all, you have to understand, Ampei is an incredible architect and gentleman and dear friend. And this was far from the first project that we had worked on together. Iam is, if you will, sort of the maestro, the conductor, and I think of myself as maybe first violin if I'm lucky. What's happened as we work together is that a lot of trust has developed, and so often much of the aesthetic is a mixture. It's not solely Ampei, and it's definitely not solely us, but it's that collaboration which has worked extremely well. Now, the Miho Museum is a very tough project because it's located on a lonely ridge in the mountains and extremely difficult to get to it even. But I am like the site because of the fantastic views and because of the loveliness of the place. Originally, the mountain area had been used for foresting trees for temple building, mostly in Nara and Kyoto. I am like the site, and he came up with the idea of putting the building on one ridge, and the entrance to the building on the far side of a second one. So what you do is you drive or you take the bus to a kind of waiting area, and then you walk up a kind of a road and then through a tunnel, and you come out of the tunnel and cross a bridge and arrive at the museum. Now, in Shigaraki, where this museum is located, all the roofs are tile. It's mandated by custom and law. But, of course, they allow skylights. So that led almost immediately to the solution where The museum is mostly underground, which is, by the way, very good for a museum because it provides very heavy thermal protection for the building being underground. And also there was a height limit on the, on structures that could be built in that area. This is a very rural area. So it was not a place for a multi-story museum. So IAM came up with some wonderful, wonderful ideas. And our chore was to come up with a kind of concept for the museum as a whole, and then to do the detailed design for the skylights, which is probably the most striking part of the museum, if you take away the wonderful spaces and the art itself, because the rest of it is underground, so you don't really see any structure. The bridge was a collaboration between Mr. Pei and myself, and it is in fact a very beautiful bridge. It received an outstanding award from the International Association of Bridge and Structural Engineers, and the people in Japan didn't really understand how little bridge in the mountains of Japan would receive an award from this very prestigious organization that normally provides its awards to great suspension spans and the like. And the reason, of course, is because it was innovative in many, many ways in terms of the use of materials and also it's a very handsome bridge, both as you cross it, that is, as you walk across it or drive across it, you have one kind of aesthetic. But as you go to the side and look at it, it has a very different aesthetic. Both of them are unusual,
yeah,
and striking and very human.
Exactly. And the setting is so beautiful. It works so beautifully in that place. And the architect he conceived this design as he wanted it to feel as though you're on a journey to a hidden paradise.
Mm.
A pilgrimage in which the bridge plays a dramatic and breathtaking role. When does the structural engineer enter the room in the course of designing a building or a structure?
Well,
is it from the very outset?
Structural engineers are like people. We're all different, and we play different roles, and we have different inputs into society. And I can't speak for the profession as a whole, but what really, really works in a project, if an architect designs a building, it can be really, really wonderful, and there are thousands, tens of thousands of examples like that. When an engineer designs a building, again, in isolation from the architect, it is very seldom as successful. There are some examples, but not very many. In my view, it's that collaboration between the architect and the engineer that puts together the really wonderful projects that make the people who approach them, work in or live in them, understand and feel that it's very special. So collaboration, in my view, is what it's all about. And it depends a lot on the project. We did a project with IAM Pei in Hong Kong. It's called the Bank of China Tower, and it's for the Bank of China. IAM's father was the president of the Bank of China, and they came to him and asked him to design a new headquarters building for them in Hong Kong. And later, they asked him to design one for them in Beijing. But sticking to the one in Hong Kong, a very tough assignment because there was another building just a block away called the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, which is a magnificent building done by the architect Norman Foster. which is a little smaller than the Bank of China and about half as tall. But it had the advantage of three times the budget. And so it's you don't just embark upon a project if you're prideful person, and I guess most of us are, unless you think you can do something that is as good as or better, but recognizing you have only a third as much money. So I am first worked out the shape of the building, and that was a square building in which quarter at a time dropped off in pie-shaped sections dropped off. So only a single wedge went to the very top. So it, if you will, it kind of pyramids upward, but unsymmetrically. And then the next question is, you know, how to make it work. And so he and I worked on that issue for about a year. And we came up with the ideas of how to put in a bracing in the building, bracing maybe like the Sears building in Chicago is bracing on the facade. This is very different, but that kind of bracing. But in a much more complex shape. And how to put it together, that is how to, the kind of craftsmanship of how you can assemble a building like that. And at the end of that time, he concluded that we could, in fact, build a building which was aesthetically and functionally competing with the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. And so he signed a commission to do so. So I would say we started on the project as soon as it came into being.
Yeah.
Or before it came into being, I guess we could say, because we worked on it for a year without any hope of compensation even.
Yeah. With the hope you would, it would
all
come
work out.
Through. Yeah, all work
well,
out.
Well, you have to, yeah, I guess so. But as a complete aside, when it came to settling a contract with the Bank of China, they said to me, well, we will pay you in Hong Kong dollars. And I said, oh, no, you pay us in United States dollars. And they said, no, Hong Kong dollars. And I said, well, you're in the international money business, and we're not. So U.S. dollars. And they said, sorry. So I waved goodbye and went home because it's the kind of risk that we couldn't take. It was too big a risk. And eventually everyone cooled off and we got paid in U.S. dollars.
Mr. Robertson, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Leslie Robertson has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's visiting the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where this evening he will present the Michael J. Tice Memorial Lecture. The lecture is set for 7 p.m. at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall, located on East Laredo Taft Drive in Champaign, and the public is invited. It's 154. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the board this afternoon, futures in both the corn and the bean pits going down, touching some support levels, actually going through a couple of them and then bouncing back up. A bit of a surprise, I think, to some traders that happened, but we'll see how things pan out over the next several days, and we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing out of Normal, Illinois, about all of the technical issues happening at the Chicago Board of Trade at this hour of the day. When we get to him at about 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time, not too far away here. Let's start in the wheat pit where we always do for the day from the Board of Trade. Soft red winter wheat, the May contract. Futures traded to a high today of 314, low at 308 and a 3/4, and a settlement price 313 and a half. They were up 3.5 cents today. July futures up 3.5 as well in the wheat pit. That's your harvest month, 324 the high, the low at 17 and a half, and a settlement price in the July wheat at $3.23.5. Once again, they were 3.5 higher. September futures 330.5 the high, the low at 325.5. Settlement price 329.5 up 1.5, and December a penny and a half higher as well. 340.5 the high, the low at 335.5. December wheat settled 3.39.5, and the March contract at 3.46.5 was up 1.5 for the day. From the corn pit nearby Macon, track 206, the high, the low at 203, settled $2.05.75, up a penny and 3/4 for the day. July futures, 2.14.5 high, low at 2.11.25, a settlement price at 2.14. They're up a penny and a half. September futures, 2.21.5 the high, the low at 2.18.75. Settlement price at 2.21.25 for the SEP corn, up 1.5, and the December contract now, 2.31 the high, low at 2.28.25. Settlement price at 2.30.75. They were up 1.25 on the day. That's your December contract. March futures, 2.37.75 the high, the low at 35.75. Settled up on the high for the day at $2.37.75 for the March 2006 corn, up a penny, and the May futures were up 1 cent as well. 240 the high, rather 242 the high, the low at 240. The settlement price up on the high at $2.42 a bushel. May oats for the day, 159.5 the high, the low at 154.5, settled 158, up 3/4. And July oats were up 2 cents today at $1.57. From the soy complex now, nearby May beans, 618 the high, the low at 602. Settlement price 6.16.75, up 4.75, and July beans 6.25 the high, the low at 6.10.5, settled 6.24.5. They were up a nickel for the day. August contract 6.23.5 the high, low at 6.09. Settlement price at 6.22.75, up 3.75. And September futures at 6.17.5 for the high, the low at 6.03, settled 6.17.5. They were up 8 cents in the SEP soybeans for the day. November contract up 6 cents, 6.13 the high, the low at 5.99.5, a settlement price there at $6.12.5 for the day. And the January 6.15.5 the high, the low at 6.02, settled up on that high at $6.15.5 for the January beans, up 7.5. May bean meal 187.80 the high, the low at 182.50, settled 187.50. They were up $2 even. And July bean meal 188.30 the high, the low at 184.10, settled 188.20. They were up 1.20. May bean oil for the day 22.50 the high, the low at 22.07, settled 22.40. They were 13 higher. And July bean oil 22.66 the high, the low at 22.24, settled 22.61. Up 12 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. April feeder cattle, 108.70 the high, 108 even the low, 108.47.5 the settlement, that up a nickel. May, 105.25 the high, 104.60 the low, 104.97.5 the settlement, that up 17.5. August, 107.20 the high, 106.45 the low, 106.87.5 the settlement, that down a nickel. April live cattle, 88.50 the high, 87.87.5 the low, the settlement 88.02.5, down 25. June, 84.10 the high, 83.45 the low, 83.67.5 the settlement, that down a nickel. April lean hog, 69.02.5 the high, the low, 68.22.5 the settlement, 68.